Oscar Beasley learned to ride a bicycle when he was 6 years old, but he didn't really get into it until 40 years later, and then he was really hooked. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For the last 40 years, Oscar Beasley has logged many miles and seen many parts of the world from the seat of his bicycle. He's written about his adventures and the benefits of bicycling as exercise in the book, Bicycling, A Lifelong Means of Staying Fit. Later in the hour, archery is taking off as a high school sport in Iowa. I'll talk with a coach and two young competitors as they prepare for state competition. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about two sports that can be enjoyed throughout a lifetime. In about 30 minutes, we'll talk about archery. But first, bicycling. And if you think cycling is not something that can be enjoyed throughout a lifetime, my guest is going to prove you wrong. Dr. Oscar Beasley got bitten by the cycling bug when he was 46 years old, and over the last 41 years, he has ridden a lot of miles. He's written about his adventures and the benefits of bicycling as exercise in the book Bicycling, A Lifelong Means of Staying Fit, and he's putting the finishing touches on a second volume right now. Dr. Beasley, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So you learned to ride a bike when you were 6 years old, but you didn't ride much. When you were in your 40s, what was it that made you start thinking about the bicycle again?
Well, it was the Arab oil crisis, the first one, which was in 1973. I live on the east side of Iowa City, about a mile and a quarter from Mercy Hospital, where I had my practice. And if you recall, if you're old enough to recall, on a Sunday morning in 1973, you couldn't find five gallons of gas for love or money. A partner of mine, Dr. Carl Larson, living in the same area, said to me, "O.C., why don't we ride our bicycles to work?" I said, "Gosh, Carl, I'm too old. I'm 46. And he gave me the answer, which, of course, I wanted, was, "No, you're not." And so I took down my seldom used, fairly new green Schwinn bicycle, bought at Novotny's, and dusted it off, pumped up the tires, and to my surprise, made it all the way to Mercy Hospital and back. This was on a weekend when there was no pressure on me. That was the beginning of it, and I started riding to work, and so did Carl.
So that ride to work was just a couple of miles, right?
Correct.
But it felt like a pretty big victory.
Oh, I was surprised. Yes, I had not done that ever. Well, perhaps in my adolescent years I did, but not since.
So it started with riding back and forth to work. How did it get to be something more?
The telling event was that I subscribed to Bicycling Magazine. And
which the fact that you subscribed to Bicycling Magazine already tells me that you were getting pretty interested.
Yes, I'd been riding to work regularly, and I was curious about these things called 10 speeds. My local bicycle merchant here was Lee Novotny, and he had no interest in these. He liked the old Sturmey Archer shifting, but I got interested in this. I bought a 10-speed from him and also subscribed to this magazine. And the thing that got me started on distance riding was an article that appeared in the spring of 1975 entitled Foxy Grandpa, 3,400 miles in 34 days. I read the article with great interest. He was 70 years of age, a tall, white-haired man, showing his picture on the first page. And I was astounded that a man 70 years of age could ride 100 miles a day, 34 days straight. It changed my view of what age had to do with exercise.
All right. And it made you want to give that a try?
It did indeed. The first ride that comes to mind was a ride to Davenport. Now, to be truthful, there was a nice west wind that day, which I didn't really appreciate in the early days. And
so
on
you had a
weekend,
nice tailwind.
Exactly, a nice tailwind. I wound up in Davenport. Bick's Beiderdecke jazz concert was going on there, which I didn't even bother to go to, but I did make it the 60 miles and phoned my wife to come and get me, and we drove back.
Now, I have to ask you, because several of your early stories of these journeys that you took end the same way, with you calling someone to come and get you to take you back. How did your wife respond to this new interest and to those phone calls?
I would say moderately, and no great enthusiasm about it. She never joined me with it, and she was cooperative, but it was a bit of a chore more than anything else. The greatest resistance I met was when I, after reading all three of the Foxy Grandpa articles in Bicycling Magazine, I told her I wanted to ride to my hometown, which was Paducah, Kentucky. And she really thought this was crazy. But then at that same time, the Press Citizen began publishing articles on a race in France, the race from Paris to, I believe it was called Brest. And a cardiologist at the university by the name of Herman Falsetti had participated in this and done very well and really made the paper. She read this and sort of backed off. And so in the fall of 1975, I started out on a beautiful day in October to go to Kentucky, and it worked out great. I had tailwinds except for one day, and I made it in 4 days, which was 456 miles. And that really was the bug that bit me for my next 40 years.
On that first journey, the one to Paducah, Kentucky, did you camp along the way? Did you stay at hotels?
No,
what did you do?
I had my military service, and I never liked camping, and I never did go camping on my trips. I always found motels or bed and breakfasts.
All right. So a good bed to sleep in was a key component of the journey for you.
That was a demand that I held, yes.
Now, after that trip to Paducah, Kentucky, how did that change your outlook? Because, I mean, obviously you got excited, but how did that change your idea of what you were capable of doing?
Well, it really gave me a great confidence. Here I was getting near 50 years of age, and I'd accomplished something that in my own mind I didn't think was possible. Long-distance bicycle riding was not that well known in 1975. The great year was the celebration of the nation in 1976 when I forget the name of the cross-country ride was established across America, and biking really took off in the late 70s.
Now, a lot of different fitness crazes also took off in the 70s. Had you been an exerciser before the bicycle bug bit?
I'm sorry to say I had not. In fact, I was never really good at any particular sports, even tennis or golf. I just found that cycling was something that I could do. It didn't take a lot of skill and just needed to be stubborn and stick with it.
So how did you feel your body changing once you started really cycling?
I can't say that I remember any particular difference. Now, I did ride regularly. It was not just a burst now and then, but I rode to work regularly and weekends, and everything was gradual. I don't remember anything strikingly different.
As a doctor, did you think about that? I mean, you were treating people, probably some people who could really benefit from different exercises.
I did indeed, Ben. It was certainly a big factor in addition to the old age thing that I discussed. Yes, I was seeing people in their late 40s, men in particular, having heart attacks. And I was aware of that. And the factor of exercise as being protective against heart disease had already been established some years before that.
Did you start preaching the gospel of bicycling to your patients?
I wouldn't say that I preached the gospel to them, but I did in one particular way I did, in that running was already quite popular by then, and I was a general internist, usually seeing people in the upper brackets of age, and as their knees gave out, thanks to osteoarthritis of the knee joints, as probably everyone knows now, the knees don't tolerate, in most cases, lifelong running. It does in some. So my advice was to change to bicycling. It's far easier on the knee joints, but still provides the cardiac exercise.
Did you have any knee problems or any injuries that you had to deal with cycling?
I had a continual problem on long-distance rides with my left knee. I talked to my late friend, Dr. Jerry Howe, about this. He was an orthopedist with the Steinler Clinic, and he advised me just with a brief look that I did not have a major problem, and so I simply got along with it, and in those days I took aspirin for relief when I had pain from a long ride.
I can imagine that there were probably people in your life back then who, if you told them my knee hurts when I ride my bike, would have said to you, Oscar, maybe don't ride your bike so much. Why was it worth it to you?
I guess I didn't complain very much. I was so happy that I could do these things. No, I didn't have much advice on that. Never even had it x-rayed.
Really? So you were pretty confident that it was going to be okay.
Indeed, I did.
Did you learn how to avoid hills, though?
No. Yes and no. I remember one very distinct experience when riding to Boston from Iowa City. My greatest fear was the city of Chicago. How would I get around or get through this huge city? And to make a long story short, I really went at it hard, standing up on the pedals, trying to make every stoplight and to get through as quickly as I could. And I did it. I did it successfully.
Wow.
I did it quickly. But the result was that knee really flared on me.
Yeah.
So when I got near Cleveland, I talked to a truck driver, and I was worried about the knee giving out on me. He said, well, you've got two choices. You can go around the city and face the hills, or you can go through the city and it's flat. I went through the city.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Dr. Oscar Beasley. He's written about his love of bicycling in the book Bicycling, A Lifelong Means of Staying Fit. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about two sports that can be enjoyed throughout a lifetime. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk about archery. We'll also talk about how archery is becoming a popular sport among high school students. The state tournament is coming up this weekend. With me right now is Dr. Oscar Beasley. He started riding his bicycle seriously when he was 46 years old. Over the last 40 years, he has been on some amazing journeys on his bicycle, and we're talking about those journeys. He's written about them in the book Bicycling, A Lifelong Means of Staying Fit. He's also putting the finishing touches on a second volume about his journeys. And if you are a cyclist and have taken some amazing journeys, you are welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Oscar, you read about this Foxy Grandpa in Bicycling Magazine and were inspired by the journeys that he took. You also decided that you would go and ride your bike in England, go on a bicycling journey in England. Was that a direct inspiration?
I would say so. It was 2 years after I read about Foxy Grandpa.
And so why England? What was the appeal?
Well, looking back 35 years, I don't remember exactly. I think the fact that it was a language that I spoke, it was a distance that I could hopefully cover in the time I could take off from work. I was a full-time medical right. practitioner
it's
in
a,
those
it's
days.
It's a smaller island than...
Right. And, the combination of the length of time, the length of the journey, and the language issue were the deciding factors.
And you went all by yourself?
I did. I copied or emulated Foxy Grandpa again.
Why go alone? I know you didn't take all of your journeys alone, but was that part of the appeal for you?
No, I think it's nice to have a companion. My earlier rides were, well, I should say rides in that period were with my partner, medical partner, Dr. Carl Larson, who I again give the credit for getting me into this. And I don't remember why he was not interested, but I then and subsequently have done many solo rides across country.
How is it different when you ride solo as opposed to riding with a partner?
Both have their advantages. It's nice to have a companion. The issue of having a breakdown or an injury or a sickness certainly enhances the value of having a companion. On the other hand, you set your own pace. You stop and take pictures when you wish. You make your own choices. It's a trade-off.
Now, speaking of injuries, breakdowns, illnesses, you've had plenty of those. I mean, on that first big trip in England, you bent your pedal getting into Edinburgh, Scotland. You had some wheel issues. Were you prepared for that? Did you know how to fix your bike?
I was not a terribly good mechanic. I had really very little experience with it. I guess I was lucky. The England thing. Reverting for a moment back to your question about companionship or solo riding, I think that's best illustrated by this event. When you're alone, people will talk to you, and you can get into conversations which you might not do if you have someone with you. I had a number of opportunities to talk to people and learn about things because I was alone. For example, in Scotland, I had my first breakdown when one of the saddlebags on the rear of the bike had a strap break and it fell into the spokes. I broke several spokes, and I was nevertheless able to get the bike into the town of Perth, and was treated royally. I was a foreigner, of course, and I was alone, and they couldn't do enough for me. They were very kind and very solicitous to my problems.
So you think that in a way being alone made your trips less lonely?
Yes. I fell into conversations with people that I would not have had I been with someone else. That's my principal point here. For example, where to stay in London. I did not have much extra money in those days, and I ran into a gentleman in Scotland who was my age, and we sat and had supper together, and he told me about where to stay in London, a place that I could afford easily, was on the tube, and I did exactly what he said, and he was right about it. It helped me a lot. The same thing happened in other instances, the same way. Being alone, people were willing to talk to me, and I think that's a factor in going alone.
Did you ever have a problem that forced you to call a trip off mid-journey?
Only once. Spring of the year, I was not conditioned well. I intended to ride from Iowa City to Kansas City to visit my oldest daughter. And I got as far as Sigerty, I think it was, and I just... I had low back pain. I just felt tired. I just felt I just wasn't able to make it. And I said, I'm not going to do it. And so I just phoned one of my other kids and said, drive down and pick me up. I'm going to call it quits. I don't remember any other time that I canceled a trip.
Reading about some of your trips, there were some times when I think maybe if I were you, I would have called it quits. I mean, there was one trip that you were on with a companion where both of you contracted an intestinal parasite. You got Giardia.
Yes.
which is pretty nasty.
That's right. And Dr. Carl Larson was a very bright and competent internist, and he recognized the symptoms before I did. When he told me what he thought it was, I said, I think you're right, Carl. It fits perfectly. But giardiasis is a now well-known intestinal parasite that can be contracted by drinking water in the western states. It was not well-known in 1978 when we were making this trip from Seattle back to Iowa. But we managed to tolerate it and to get home. And as soon as we got here, we had immediate diagnosis at the state laboratory, and within 2 days, we're well again, thanks to treatment.
Wow. That must have been a tough journey, though.
It toughened the journey. It didn't empower the musculoskeletal system wasn't affected by it. It was simply an unpleasant gastrointestinal thing with stomach ache and diarrhea and so on.
I'm talking with Dr. Oscar Beasley. He's written about his lifelong love of bicycling in the book Bicycling, A Lifelong Means of Staying Fit. You're working on a second volume, too. What's that one called?
The name is quite similar. I entitled it Bicycling Volume 2, an activity that has no age limits.
Nice. We're going to go to the phones here in a moment. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you've taken some amazing journeys on your bicycle and would like to tell us about them, give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Kurt is on the line in North Liberty. Hi, Kurt.
Hello.
Hi, and you're a cyclist. What got you into it?
About 7-8 years ago, I had a medical issue with my foot. And I was putting on weight, laying around doing nothing. And I asked the doctor if I could ride a bike possibly to, you know, exercise. And he said that wouldn't be a problem. And I bought a bike. And unfortunately, it was a mountain bike, which was a bad choice. And then a neighbor who at that point I didn't know saw me ride mine and the difficulty I was having, suggested I use his bike, which was a little thinner tires, a little better frame, and try that for a couple weeks. And he converted me. And so after a couple of years, I got up to about 4,000 miles a year, and I convinced myself I could maybe do a long ride. And I rode across Missouri, went from Kansas border to the Illinois, St. Louis. And actually, Brian Fleck, my friend, I met him halfway in Columbia, and we finished out the trip. Other than a couple of thorns in the tires, and I had flu for the last 70 miles, it was a fun trip.
So it was a great way to exercise, drop a few pounds. What is it about cycling that got you hooked enough to do these big journeys?
Well, I think one is it's a solo sport or a group sport. So you can go out and you lose yourself in what's around you by yourself. Or if you're with a group, you can slow down and talk and stop and have a beer. If you see something on the side of the road, you stop and look at it. And that's the things you don't see when you're in a car.
And what's the allure of the big epic journeys?
I did it. You know, it's like I never in my wildest dreams thought that I could ride across the state. You know, given my foot was I couldn't walk very well, and to just say, okay, I've done 4,000 miles around Johnson County, I can certainly do across the state, and I did it.
Wow. Well, Kurt, thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
Well, thank you.
And Oscar, looking at the journeys that you detailed just in your first book, I mean, you make the United States look kind of like a bicycle tire because you've got spokes going to California and Washington State and New Orleans and way down to Florida and all the way to Boston and up to Maine as well. Or is that No, I'm all right. So you've been so many places in the United States, gone on so many of these epic journeys. What is the attraction of that kind of journey to you?
I haven't mentioned photography, but I've always had an interest in it, and that has grown as the years have gone by. And I have to say that as I've gotten into old age, I put more emphasis on the photography than I do on the bicycling. And this second book that I'm having printed right now is free of any long-distance solo rides. Since I had prostate cancer in 1997, I've not gone alone on long trips. I've either gone with groups, usually commercially run groups, or I've toured cities. I've become a fan of touring large cities on the bike because, as Kurt just said in his excellent phone call, he said many of the things that I have experienced myself. The driving force. Why do you do this? Why do you go 4,000 miles? It's kind of to say, well, I did it. I'm pleased with myself.
And does it change how you think about yourself once you can know that you can accomplish something like that?
It does. I think it gives you self-confidence. It makes you feel good about yourself, even though the calendar says you're 70 plus, 80 plus years of age. It restores confidence. One more thing on this last book, because that's my last 15 years of writing, is the thing I discovered when I was in Portland after when I retired from practice. My group gave me a present. This was a tour of the Oregon coast, an upscale tour, a very elegant ride and high-level upscale facilities. And that was great. But the thing I enjoyed most turned out to be an extra day that I had in Portland before I flew back home. And this very bicycle-friendly city really impressed me. It was a beautiful city in the first place, but it was so easy to get around on a bicycle. So I came home very interested in following this up with other city rides. On a beautiful fall day that same year, I drove into Chicago and spent the weekend cycling there, and it was really a great deal of fun, and many other people were doing it. So subsequently, I've toured cities both here and in Europe and found it to be an ideal way to visit places.
Well, and cities have gotten a lot more bicycle-friendly throughout your years of riding as well.
You're exactly right. And in my most recent trip to Europe, I talked friends of mine into signing up with an outfit called the Fat Tire Bicycle Company, which is now available in most of the European cities. And it certainly beats riding on a bus. And it's inexpensive. It's safe, in my opinion. You can take all the pictures you want. It's ideal, and I've done it in a number of cities in Europe.
Well, we have a Cable on the line in Iowa City, and he has anticipated my next question, so I'll let him ask it. Hi, Cable.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your question for Dr. Beasley?
Dr. Beasley, how you doing?
Fine. Are you Cable Gray?
I am. I'm so thrilled to hear you on the radio talking about your passion.
Good to hear from you.
Yeah. Hey, so I've done a couple tours up the Mississippi River, and there was a moment in time when the skies blackened out in the west, and it's an organized ride every June, and the skies blackened, and the wind started whipping up, and it started raining so hard and blowing so hard that people were literally being blown off their bicycles, and you could see the waves of water coming down the road, and so this was one of those moments in time on one of my rides that will always be very vivid to me. So my question to you is there any time during your experiences that you think back and say, wow, this was that moment that I will always remember, either because I was really suffering or because the memory just really wowed me.
Yes, one learns most from painful events, I think. Two things come to mind. When I rode from Los Angeles back to Kansas City, I had a day in the Mojave Desert when it was 110 degrees, and when I finally got into the motel at night, I was really grateful to be there. It had been a very difficult day. That's one. And the other one that popped in my mind was when I rode to Boston. It rained every day as I crossed New York State. And just before I got to Albany, it was just a downpour, almost as bad as you described. Not quite the wind, but just continuously soaking wet.
That sounds miserable, but I also have a feeling you wouldn't trade it.
No. Again, I made it.
You're right.
I'm glad there's the exhilaration that comes from having succeeded.
Oscar Beasley, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Oscar Beasley has written about his lifelong love of bicycling in the book Bicycling, A Lifelong Means of Staying Fit. He's working on the second volume about his passion for bicycling and his journeys right now, putting the finishing touches on it. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Katniss Everdeen is the heroine of the Hunger Games trilogy. Against all odds, she keeps herself alive, tries to protect those that she loves, and leads a revolution against a totalitarian regime, and she does it all with the help of her trusty bow. Archery has also felt the impact of Katniss Everdeen. There was an uptick in interest, particularly from girls, when the books became popular, but even more girls have been moved to pick up a bow since the first movie came out 3 years ago. And now, more young people in Iowa are getting a chance to give archery a try. Denise Peterson is here. She's the outreach coordinator for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and works with the National Archery in the Schools program. Hello, Denise.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And Dave Beeson is also here today. He's a high school PE teacher in Johnston, and they also participate in the National Archery in the Schools program. Hello, Dave.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And Denise, give me an idea of what the National Archery in the Schools program is. I know there are a couple different elements to it.
Yeah, so there's actually two ways that schools can be involved in the National Archery in the Schools program. One, they can, first they have to shoot archery within their school system, it usually is within the physical education program, and then they can get involved in our after-school archery in the schools program. And that is what we're mostly talking about today, is the competition side of it.
Okay, and for a school to get involved in the program, what does a PE teacher need to go through?
We have an 8-hour training called the Basic Archery Instructor Program, BAI, and as I mentioned, it is a full 8 hours. They need to go through that. It's free for teachers who are able to instruct within their physical education class, but then after-school coaches or parents or any others that are interested in doing the after-school portion of the program would pay a small fee of $40 to get that basic archery instructor certification.
And how many students in Iowa are now participating in the program?
We have 200 schools that are doing the program through physical education, but around 50 schools that are doing the after-school portion. And within those 50 schools, we have about 2,000, a little over 2,000 archers competing in tournaments.
All right. And I was talking about how a lot of girls have been interested in taking up archery because of Katniss Everdeen. What's the split? How many girls, how many boys?
We actually have around 968 females and about 1,140 archers that are males. So we're getting close to a 50-50 split.
Wow, that is pretty close. And before the Hunger Games became a thing, do you know what the split would have been like?
The actual Archery in the Schools program requires that four of the opposite gender are on a team, that make up the team. But you can see that there are higher numbers within the female division, but there it's also because there's more schools involved. So we couldn't really relate to, yes, it is because of the Hunger Games movie, so there could be some correlation.
All right. And Dave, in Johnston, you've been doing archery for a long time, right?
Yes, we've done archery for as long as I've been here.
And, well, first of all, let me ask you, why is that? Why did you feel like having archery as part of your PE curriculum was a good idea?
Well, it's a lifelong activity. And at Johnston, our PE program, we have it set up with different tracks so students can go in different areas of interest. And so what I teach are lifetime activities. And so it was a natural fit for archery to go into that section.
All right. And this National Archery in the Schools program is pretty recent. You were doing archery in Johnston well before that. But what was appealing about this program?
Well, what we used to do was we would shoot recurve bows. We were out back behind the school shooting in the grass. You'd lose arrows in the grass all the time. The wind would blow the targets over. You'd break your arrows. And then along come this NASP program, and I'd heard about it. It was shooting inside. You could shoot outside if you wanted, but it was using compound bows, which is a newer technology, would say, in the archery world. And so it was just appealing to go to something more up-to-date.
What's the difference between a recurve bow and a compound bow?
Okay. A compound bow gives you a mechanical advantage. It has pulley and a cam system that makes it easier to draw the bow back versus the recurve where it's probably more like what you would see in the movie Hunger Games where the bow has a curve to it that curves back on its own limbs.
Okay, so more what we've always traditionally seen. Robin Hood shooting.
Yeah, that type of thing.
All right. And let me ask you what I asked Denise a few minutes ago. So since you've been doing archery in Johnston for a long time, have you seen a real increase in young women being interested in getting involved?
Well, like I said, I started this in 2006. And back when we first started, I had to actively recruit to get the girls on the team because of the rule that you needed so many of the opposite gender. In the last few years, that's not the case. We've got pretty even split on our team. I'd say we're close to 50-50. I don't have to do the active recruiting anymore there. So whether you can, you know, put that to the Hunger Games, I don't know.
But there may be a correlation there.
There possibly is.
All right, so you were talking about shooting within gym class, but in 2006 is when you started doing the after-school program as well?
Yes.
All right, and tell me a little bit about the archery season as an after-school program, as a team sport.
Well, we begin our season just after Thanksgiving, between Thanksgiving and December 1st, and that season then will run up until, for us, till the state shoot, which is this year, March 7th.
All right, so it's coming up on Saturday.
Right. Now, some schools will extend that and participate in the national competition. We have not been involved in the national competition here at Johnston. We make our season end. We'll have that end at the state shoot.
And I said after-school program, but you actually have a before-school program, right?
Yes. It's very hard to, you know, the season runs in correlation with basketball season. Gym time is very hard to come by. And so we have found that we catch a window of opportunity at about 6:30 in the morning. We start setting up. We try to be shooting by 6:45, and we'll shoot right up until our first hour. So for 6:45 till 7:45, that's the time we practice every morning.
Wow. How many kids do you have on the team?
Well, we started off the year with around 60 kids coming in, and through the course of the year, we've added some, dropped some, and we have on a regular basis about 40 to 45 coming in.
That's a pretty impressive number for 6:45 in the morning, I think.
Yeah, that requires a little dedication to get up that early.
We've had some pretty high-profile archers from the state of Iowa. Doreen Wilbur of Jefferson, that's one of my favorite stories. She won the gold medal in archery in 1972, and she was 42 years old when she did that, which is incredible. But just in recent years, we've had Matt Stutzman. He won a silver medal at the 2012 Paralympic Games. He does not have arms, so he shoots with his feet. I've interviewed Matt, and he's just a remarkable individual. Miranda Leek is also a very high-level competitor in archery. Denise, do you feel like some of these high-profile competitors are also bringing some interest to the sport in the state?
Yeah, absolutely. And Bridger's another one. He also competes with Miranda, too. We've even had archers from the Archery in the Schools program that went on to Worlds, or to Nationals and Worlds, and then even made the USA team and competed in South Africa. Two of those archers were from Iowa. So it is amazing that archers from Iowa can be on these national programs and, again, give Iowa some representation.
Dave, are you an archer yourself?
Yes.
How long have you been an archer?
I picked the sport up probably around the mid-80s.
Okay, so does it pretty much coincide with teaching it for you?
Well, yeah. I remember when I was in high school, we shot archery in high school. So then I never picked a bow up after that until I guess I moved to the Johnston area here, and some of my teacher friends were bow hunters, and so that's how I got involved. And so I don't actually shoot competitions, 3D competitions, or the but target archery shoots that go on, but I do bow hunt.
And what do you enjoy about it?
Well, for me, the bow hunting's the that's very peaceful, to go out and sit in a tree stand in the middle of the woods on a beautiful fall day. That's therapy.
Dave, in watching your students who become a part of the archery team, and you're with them for quite a long season from November through March, what do you see them getting out of it?
There's a lot of personal growth. I think their confidence level really is boosted by, I think it's just the development they have from the start of the year till the end. Something that was very much a challenge to them, they to a certain degree, they master the sport, and with that comes a degree of confidence that they understand that's something they can do that most kids can't. So.
I know you have a couple of your student-athletes with you today. Can you pass the phone to Taylor Hall?
I certainly will.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hello.
Hi, Taylor. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And Taylor, you're a senior at Johnston?
Yes, I am.
How long have you been involved with archery?
I've been involved since I was a sophomore, so 3 years.
All right. And what was it that attracted you to the sport?
Well, the first thing that got me in was just that all of my friends were doing it. And then I just really stuck with it because it was something that I could do, and there weren't a lot of things that I was really heavily involved in, but that was one that I really felt like I could do this.
So there weren't other sports that you enjoyed?
Yeah, no, I'm not really a sports person.
Okay, so taking up archery, did that surprise some people about you?
Yeah, it surprised myself, really. I never thought that I would be involved in sports, but then archery came around, and I really loved it.
What was it that made you fall in love with it?
I think there's a lot that you can learn about yourself from it. Like, being aware of your own body and controlling it is very hard to do, but it's a very important thing to learn.
And what are your hopes for Saturday?
I'm hoping that I beat my high score from last year.
All right. And what was your high score last year?
269.
And what's the highest you can score?
300.
Okay, 269 sounds incredible.
Yeah.
All right, well, you're certainly aiming high. Taylor, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Taylor Hall is one of the members of the Johnston Archery team. And can you hand the phone to Brianna?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Hello?
Hi, Brianna.
Hi.
Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, of course.
So, Brianna, how long have you been a part of the archery team?
I have been in archery for 3 years, now, so sophomore year.
Okay. Started. And what attracted you to archery?
I thought it was, like, just really a really unique sport, and it was just different than all the other ones out there.
Were you active in other sports, too?
Sophomore year, I did volleyball. I wasn't so great at it, so I didn't quite stick with it, like, through junior and senior year, but I did enjoy it sophomore year.
Okay, and did archery feel more like something you could excel at?
Yeah, definitely. I noticed that it was just a lot easier to do than volleyball, pretty much.
Well, easier for you, probably not easier for everybody.
True.
So when you are practicing, what goes through your head when you're lining up a shot?
Really, first, like, there's 11 steps in to, like, go through to get the arrow into the center. And what our coaches had us do was write down our steps. And so pretty much it's just footwork, and then it's anchoring, making sure that you have the same anchor, like where you put your draw hand. And then just, like, focusing where on the target you want it to go, and then letting go.
And do people at school call you Katniss ever?
No, I've never been called Katniss.
Just checking.
No. But I did notice that there were a couple more people who, like, girls that came in after, like, the Hunger Games, and it was a big talk in archery about, like, how we're going to be like Katniss and everything. But in my mind, it wasn't really at all like Katniss, because the kind of bows that we shoot and the kind of archery that we do is a lot different than what she actually does.
Right, right. And so you'll be competing in state on Saturday, too?
Yes, I will.
All right. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Can you pass the phone back to Mr. Beeson?
Yes, of course.
Thank you. Brianna Erickson is another member of the Johnston High School archery team. Dave Beeson, of course, is the high school PE teacher. He's also the coach of the archery team. Hey, Dave?
Yes.
How many people do you have going to state on Saturday?
We have a full team of 24.
All right, 24. So, and they'll be scored together and separately, or how does that work?
Yeah, there'll be a team score at the end of the day, and then each archer will have their individual score.
All right. And high hopes this year?
Oh, we're gonna go all the way this year. We're going to take the title.
All right. All right. Well, Dave, thank you so much for talking with me.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Denise Peterson, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having us. We really appreciate being able to expose the archery in the schools program around the state.
Oh, thanks a lot. Denise Peterson is the outreach coordinator for the Iowa DNR. She works with the National Archery in the Schools program. And Dave Peason is, of course, the high school PE teacher in Johnston and the archery coach. Nearly 800 archers from 50 schools across Iowa will be in Des Moines on March 7th, that's Saturday, competing in the Archery in the Schools program state tournament. It's held in conjunction with the Iowa Deer Classic. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can get in touch with us. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @IPRTalk. I'm there as well @CharityNebby. Tomorrow on the show, Living with Hepatitis C. I'm Charity Nebby. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.